Welcome to the Inside College Soccer Podcast, bringing together some of the best college soccer-related people to your earbuds, from coaches to players and beyond. So, thank you for tuning in. The Inside College Soccer Podcast is brought to you by Sports Recruiting USA, the college soccer experts. Now, enjoy the show.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Strong Female Athlete Podcast. Today, we have a special soccer recruiting episode on how to play for a top 25 D1 school. So we are talking the UNCs, Stanfords, Wake Forest, all those schools that a lot of girls wish to play for. And we are here to give very honest advice so that you know if that's your level or if you're just wasting your time. And we really want to help people save time and money. So I guess starting off, Don and Andre, thanks for coming back on. I know it's been a while since the three of us have been together, but maybe we can just start off with how the Division I landscape in the top 25 teams has changed even just in the past few years.
Yeah, it's funny. I was joking with you and I think I made a tweet online. I can tell this story in five words, be on the national team. And I think from my perspective, seriously, that the way that it's changed is that there was a time not that long ago, maybe 5-10 years ago, where a young promising player who clearly wasn't going to play their freshman year and maybe even much their sophomore year, but could definitely develop and play their junior and senior year, that player was given a chance at the top 25 level. And I think those days are virtually gone, maybe not literally. I'm sure we can point to a few exceptions, but those days are gone, and they're gone for a couple of reasons. Number one, let's look at North Carolina and how they won the national championship this year. Last spring, they were down to 12 players. They had a mass exodus. They went to the transfer portal and they grabbed some true studs out of that transfer portal. So in the old days, the staff might've looked at it, okay, this is a rebuilding year. Let's go grab the best freshman we can get. We'll develop it. And within 3 years, we'll be back in that national championship hunt. And what North Carolina did, and especially with their success, is becoming a model that college coaches are following. So I think that's a major change.
Yeah, and I look at, you know, the quote unquote blue bloods, right? And, you know, what does it find a top 25 program? You know, is it a national ranking on an annual basis or the traditional top programs that have done well? And so I think Don is right. I think the 28 player roster cap has really kind of changed things as well. It's going to make it a little bit harder. A lot harder. And I do believe that the transfer portal is going to make a massive impact, right? So if you take 350 programs at the Division I level, you know, and you take maybe the top 30, 40 teams kind of bouncing back and forth. I mean, that's really, honestly, it's probably 80 to 100 players a year that are getting recruited at that level. What do you think, Don? I mean, domestically, right? With the influx of internationals as well as true freshmen.
If that, yeah, right. Yeah, the influx of internationals is look, it hasn't hit, look, on the men's side, we're approaching 40% of players that are coming into the NCAA or internationals. The women's number has held somewhere around 15% for the last 3 or 4 years. We haven't seen the incremental increase on the women's side that we've seen on the men's side. With the increased salaries in Europe on the pro women's game, the top players are choosing that path. They can go and play in Spain and you know, make close to $100,000 a year, and they're choosing that path and other countries in Europe. But there are still very high quality national team youth players in Europe that will choose to come to the U.S. and go the college route, especially with the influx of NIL money. You know, now we've got players here. I know there's three players at I think Texas had last year that were on $100,000 NIL money on the women's side, in addition to a full ride. So the money is becoming very big for the top schools, some of the top 25s, not all of them, but some of the top 25s have got big NIL money. So they are buying players from overseas. So I think that's cut into the top 25 market, maybe harder than even harder than, especially on the women's side. What do you think, Andre? It's hit the top 25 market harder than it has the, you know, numbers 100 through 300 on the women's side.
At the end of the day, I mean, yes, I believe like the national team kids are going to, you know, get the most exposure. I mean, that's pretty obvious, right? But let's get down to the nitty gritty of it. I mean, they have to be elite and exceptional, right? They've got to be identified as athletic enough to compete within the conference that they're playing in, athletic enough to deal with the opponents that they're playing against on a consistent basis. They're going to have to be technically super clean. I think that's going to be, I think what Don was saying about that time, like, hey, come here, develop, you know, do this. I think the kids now are so much cleaner. They're so much better than they had been in the past. Tactically, they're a lot more savvy as the game's developing. And then, you know, whether or not this, you know, the kids have the mental aspect of it to deal with the pressures of being in a top 25 program. I think that's really important, is that the coaches are doing a much better job long-term evaluations versus just, hey, let's just take a roll on this kid and see if it works out. And if not, you know, they'll just sit on the bench and they'll develop. That's not happening as much as they used to. And like, I'll give you a case. Don, you and I talked about this player in the past. And so I won't say the name, but I'll just kind of give you the story. All right, Erica. So this kid here in Vegas, during COVID, when everything was shut down, so I started training her. And I'm like, hey, what's your story? You know, she's 14 years old. And it's like, well, I'm like, why are you doing this? Why do you want to train? And she said, I want to be a pro. I'm like, okay. And she was adamant about it at 14. And so, you know, I'm like, okay, well, let's see what training does and how that goes. Well, the kid was super athletic as a seventh, eighth grader, strong, physically strong, just like different than any other kid, technically good on the ball. She had all these qualities about her. But the thing that really stood out was the mental aspect of it. She was so different than any other kid I had trained at that age. Like at 14, she was like so mature, so driven. And the kid sacrificed everything. She drove, you know, once she played for my U16s as an eighth grader because she could handle it. And she was like just smoking kids at that, you know, at that U16 level as a 13, 14 year old. And I'm like, this kid's going to go far. And even the kids that played with her are like, she is so good. How is she so good? Right. It's a lot of that was natural gift, but that family had a strategy. The strategy was, we're going to pull her out of a high school. We're going to put her in a really good program where it's going to allow her to academically do things online. She's going to get with a strength conditioning coach. She's going to train once or twice a week. She's going to drive to California twice a week to train and play with her team in California at a very good platform, which is important, right? To play in a really good platform and a really good team. And her recovery, her nutrition, her sleep, everything was meticulously calculated by this kid, right? And there was a time, and I'm taking a lot of time, I'm sorry, Erica, but there was a time she hit a wall, and it was that I'm just burnt out, right? And so the family kind of was like, okay, let's kind of scale it back a little bit. And this is the other area. Well, long story short, this kid did everything she needed to do to get pulled in with the U17s with Mexico, got pulled in with the U20s, played in the World Cup, got recruited by an SEC school, a good SEC school, got a great scholarship package, has a management team behind her now. Like, she has a true management team behind her. And this kid, I'm going here because this is the right coach for me. It's a top 25 program. It's in a power conference, and I want to be a pro. That, I think, is different. Is this right here is really, I think, what changes, the difference between a kid going to a top 25 or a kid just ending up at a different school.
So I want to talk about the club team that these girls are on, because I think it definitely does matter. So Don, you talked about one of the bare minimum requirements is to be on the national team, but are there some players who are playing for these top 25 schools that aren't necessarily on the U.S. youth national team, but they're on the top ECNL teams in the country. They're starting and playing a lot of minutes for their ECNL team. Is that also another like bare minimum requirement, you would say?
Well, yeah, there aren't enough kids. There aren't enough national team players to cover the top 25 schools. So at some point, you know, it's funny when you go to an event. I was at an event in, I think, no, it wasn't in Vegas. It was at a national platform event. I think it was GA, and it was their one of their big events out west. And I had noticed a player that stood out in warmups. I mean, really stood out. And by the time the game came around, there were probably 200 college coaches gathering and watching this game. And turns out they were all watching this one player. It was 6 foot center back that had all the athletic traits and leadership traits. And she was not on the national team, but she was in the pool. She was a pool player. She'd been pulled up into the pool and ended up playing at a top 25 Division I program. So yeah, she wasn't on the team, but she was noticed by the national team. You know, she was at that level and she was playing. This was a top 5, 6 GA team in the country. And she was a starter. She was a captain. She was a leader. She was a clear stud. And we had 200 coaches sitting around watching basically one player play. So yeah, that does happen. You don't have to be ECNL number one in the country and on the national team all at the same time. There are kids in the GA. You know, I don't think they're top 25 right now, but I know two kids that are playing at Iowa that played for a club that's not even in one of the major platforms. So that can happen, but we're talking in this episode top 25 D1. So it's the elite of the elite. It's the, like you said, Andre, it's 100 or less kids in the world.
Yeah, and I would say also, I think coaches do a lot of recruiting out of like the U17s World Cups. You know, they go to those events now with the purpose of identifying kids that maybe are not getting picked up by major clubs, right? And you know, they're going to these events and they're seeing these kids, especially at like the U20s, because they'll have 17-year-olds. You know, and the international kids also will not get you know, will not get seen until those events, right? And so I think that the college coaches, you know, they want players that are going to come in and be an impact. And it's funny, I think about this when I was at Northern Arizona. Like we had a kid from Venezuela that we were looking at. You know, she's part of the U17 national team. I'm like, first of all, why are you writing us? Because you know, we have no business recruiting you probably. And sure enough, she went to Florida State. She had an awesome career at Florida State, you know. And but those kids are getting a little bit more savvy. They're understanding what the process is like here in the US. There's people helping them get here as well. And you know, whether people like it or not, it is happening. And I mean, just look at college basketball and how, you know, how much changes are happening in college basketball. One day after the season's over, or during a season, during the NCAA tournament
During the
basketball,
tournament,
during
yeah.
the basketball tournament, right? Kids are looking to transfer. Within, like, while the tournament's still going on, they're getting their names in the transfer portal, right? And there are coaches that literally will, I mean, there's coaching staffs that will literally leave a coach behind to just go through the transfer portal, right? So the nature of recruiting has changed dramatically. And so you have to be exceptional. You have to stand out. If you're a forward, you have to score goals. Everybody's got it. There's got to be a buzz around this kid, you know, at every event, like Don was saying. And I think ECNL and GA, you know, I know. People say, oh, you guys are always talking down about that. I'm like, no, we're not talking down about ECNL and GA. We're saying it's not the only path, right, for every kid, but it is an awesome event. And like, I've had parents in the past who are like, I don't understand why my kid's not getting recruited by these schools. And I'm like, well, your kid has every single opportunity in the world to get recruited by these coaches because they're all sitting here and every other kid on the team is getting recruited by these teams. Maybe your kid is not at that level, right? You're sitting down in front of these coaches every week. You know, there's like a showcase or there's games going on. That opportunity is there. Maybe you're just not showcasing. Maybe, you know, the fact that you don't play, you're not the starting 11, you're in the top 14 or 15 players plays an impact in that, right? And so you not only have to be at the right platform, you not only have to be on the right team that wins, but you have to also perform when you step on the field. And I think that's, you know, that's the part that I think people forget is, like, at the end of the day, it's your performance that's going to get you recruited, right? It's your ability that gets you recruited. It's not who you play for, what club team you play for. It's, you know, what do you do when you step on the field? Like, do you make a difference? And I think that's where those programs, you know, like, can they be an impact against the rest of the ACC? Can they be an impact against the rest of the Big Ten? Can they be an impact against the rest of the Big 12? I think that's really where you have to kind of figure that out as a coach. But I honestly just believe you have to be exceptional now.
You know, Andre, when you're talking about that, that player you were talking about earlier that you coached and was making all those sacrifices, I remember very well. I think it was 2021, just coming out of COVID, and I made a trip to Vegas. And I had seen probably 40 teams play. And it was all lovely soccer, and they were all lovely players. There was a player who stood out from the entire tournament. I hadn't seen anything like this since I coached a girl who played for the Ghana national team, Sharifa Sumela. This girl was dominating. And I called you and I said, Andre, you cannot believe. And you said, who's the girl? And I look on the roster and I read her name and you go, oh yeah, that's the girl I coach. And it was this girl you were talking about, because she stood out. And that's just what you say. Just to reiterate what Andre was just saying, Erica, it's not good enough to be on even the best team in the country. It's not even close. In fact, if you look at the best team in the country and you look at most of the players on that team, at a certain level that I coached at, maybe when I was at Cal State East Bay or definitely when I was at Feather River, I would say I would take every single girl on this team. I would love for any girl on this team, including the number 18 on the roster, they could absolutely come impact my team. But if I'm recruiting for Stanford, I go, yeah, that one, and not the rest of them. And like Andre said, you know, parents wonder why their kid is on even maybe the best team in the country. And, you know, and Andre's right. It's not like not talking down about ECNL as a general platform or about GA as a general platform. But when you're on the seventh best team in your ECNL conference and you're the number 16th player on your seventh best team and we go and watch your game and there's not a college coach at your game, not one. It means that nobody is standing out. Nobody is standing out to the point where a coach says, that player there will make an impact on my team now, right now, today. It's not a joke, but I joke around that. You know, no coach needs another player like number 27 on their roster. So who needs another player that won't play for me?
And you need to be consistent. Like that, yes. You can't just have one. You just can't have one game. You got to be like week in, week out. Like these coaches track you, and they have the staff and the resources to go out and evaluate you. They have the ability to go out to national events. They have ability to travel to go watch you play. It's you know, so you have to be consistent day in and day out. And you've got to ask yourself as a player, what are you willing to sacrifice on a daily basis, right? In order to make it's like, how can you get better, right? And how can you become unique? How can you become special? What is it about you that, you know, training twice a week or 3 days a week is not going to do it for you as a player in order to play at that kind of a level? You have to be 100% in love with the process, right? And in love, and you got to love. That's why I always ask, like, what's your why behind all of this? What do you want? Like, and like, oh, I just want to play division. I'm like, that's not the reason, right? And so I think that kids have to really introspectively have some self-reflection in terms of what they think it all means, because the other part, and I know we're not talking about the men, but you know, having played because on the men's side, but playing for a top five program, there's a massive amount of stress. I can attest to that, right? As a player, there's a massive amount of stress and responsibility that goes behind being in that situation. And some kids are just not wired for that, right? To be in that pressure cooker. And so when a coach goes out and watches you play, when you're down 1-0 and there's 5 minutes left in the game, they want to see who is the player that is going to say, give me the ball. Let me finish this game. Let me score a goal. That's what they're looking for. They're looking for big moment players, right? That's why playoffs are always great, great environments. I always say that watching a player play in a showcase and watching a player play in a playoff will tell you a lot. If the player plays at the same level at the showcase that they do in the playoff, and they're like hungry and they're just a grinder, and whether it be a showcase event or whether it be a national playoff, like with a national championship implication, that's the player that you want. If that player turns off on a showcase and then, oh, I'll step up, you know, in a playoff environment, a little bit of a, like a warning sign. But if a player showcases really well in the showcase event, when there's like no pressure, like in terms of a big game, but man, they totally shut down in a national championship playoff situation, and they're like, they hide, done. Right. Because at the NCAA level, you're playing for a national championship, whether it be Division I, Division II, Division III, it's the same. Right. And so that quality, that mental side, I think that killer instinct really has to be ingrained in you. And it can't be driven by your parents or your coaches or anybody else. That has to be an intrinsic value. Right. Motivated, like personally, just motivated, intrinsically motivated.
There were a number of players who had, after the last ECNL event, national event, 2026 commit girls committed to Power Four programs who had their offers pulled right after that event, like within a day or two. You saw them back, I'm opening up my search again. It's because they didn't stand up and in the pressure of the event. The coaches went and saw, okay, like Andre said, they continue to check in on you. Even after you're committed, they continue to check in on you. They will look in on you at every single event, and they 100% will pull their offer if you're not performing up to that standard.
Yeah, I had a conversation at a club practice last night with a kid that I had a college coach text me and say, hey, I'm worried about this kid. Can you do me a favor? Kind of put a bug in their ear to step it up after they committed. And I had to go to the practice, and I talked to the team about this as a former college coach coming in, talking, addressing a team. And I pulled this kid aside and I said, hey, listen, I'm just telling you, you've got to take this up to a different level. You know, don't be comfortable once you've committed. And yeah, at the top, like those top programs. And I always say, 25, it can fluctuate, right? One year in, 1 year out. But the true blue bloods, the ones that are always fighting for final eight, you know, elite eight, college cup, those programs are killers. That's what they're looking for, which is remarkable about UNC with how many transfers that they had.
That was such an incredible story. Like, yeah, that was really cool. But
that's the nature of college athletics right now.
Yeah, yeah. And Don, it comes back to your analogy that college soccer recruiting is like dating. All these coaches have so many options, and if you don't have anything to offer consistently, then they'll get rid of you. You can't just commit and then fall off and not deliver anything to the relationship. So it just reminded me of that. I didn't know they were pulling commitments after they were made. That's crazy.
Well, it's transactional now, you know, and they, with the roster limits of 28. So let's just kind of break it down to really being realistic about this. So there's 28 players on the roster, that's 7 players per class, maybe 3 to 4 players are true freshmen. Why would you waste a roster spot on a kid that is going to have to transfer anyways, which is going to be a bigger headache later on, right? If there's no written commitment and there's just being straightforward and just saying, hey, we're going to rip the Band-Aid and move on in a different direction. I mean, coaches move in different directions. Players are moving in different directions. Coaches are leaving to go to different. I mean, that's the nature of it all, right? And so why not do it on the front end and just be honest with the player and say, hey, you know what? You're not developing at the level that we thought you were going to develop, and you're still 16 months away. We're worried about this. You know, I think that we're going to move. And sometimes it has to do with coaching changes too, right, Don? So like a new coaching staff comes in, you had a prior commitment to that school, and the coaching staff is like, hey, listen, it's not what I look for. I know you've committed here. You might want to think about reopening your recruiting process. It's early enough. You're going to find a home, right? And it happens quite a bit. But I think the days of like, hey, I'm going to go here, and, you know, if I don't play the first year, it's okay. It's you just don't have room. You know, it's like, I had a coach tell me this, like, I have 32 lock, I have 20, someone said I had 32 lockers and they were asking me to carry 34 players. And I want to make sure that the only space that we have here is for every kid that has to have their own locker, right? And so they're like, if we have 28 locker room spaces, that's it. You know, if you're not carrying your weight here, it's time for you to clean out your locker and find a place that you can, you know, thrive and be a better player. And it's not going to be here. And that's happening more and more. And I don't see that ch ever changing again. That's gone. That boat has sailed. That ship has sailed.
So I
Just to
have a
reiterate, we're talking about that top level. We're not talking about, you know, I hate when people generalize. You know, this isn't every D1 in the country. There's going to be D1 coaches that hear this that are going to cringe and go, "Well, that's not my program." You know, when my word is my bond. When I commit to a player, I've committed to that player. I will own them for 4 years. I will never ask them to leave. And those are also D1 schools that are not competing for a top 25 spot and aren't winning national championships. And there are D2s and there are D3s. And there are D3 coaches out there that are cutthroat, just like Andre's talking about, and D2 coaches that are cutthroat, just like Andre's talking about, and NAIA coaches that are that cutthroat. And then there are those who their word is their bond. They're going to stick it through with that kid. They truly do consider their team's families. Which is why Andre and I are constantly talking about what's the right fit for you. For a certain player, they need to be in that cutthroat environment. That's what they want. They want their job to be on the line at every single practice. They thrive in that environment. There are players that thrive on a college, on a coach throwing garbage cans and swearing at them. They thrive in that. They need that. I've had players that say, "Get on me. You know, push me," not literally, but "push me harder. You're not, why are you so quiet today, coach? I need you to get on me." And then there are other players that if you get on them, they fold like a wet blanket. That's not what they need. That's not what they want. The coach that throws a garbage can would scare the heck out of them and they'd quit right there on the spot. They can't take it. That's not what they want. Maybe they come from an abusive home with a yeller and a screamer, and that's not what they want. Or maybe that's what drives them. And so it really is. What is the right fit for an individual as a player? Not, you know, what scenario fits everybody, because it doesn't work that way.
So, Erica, you went to a really good academic school, like a great academic school, like unbelievable reputation academically. You know, like, hey, you know, maybe your standards are 1550 to get in with your SAT. You have to have like this off the charts GPA with a lot of like high, you know, AP courses, right? It's just a different level. Not everybody gets in, right? Not everybody gets into that school. Right. It's the same thing with soccer. It's the same thing with athletics. You know, you might have this aspiration of like hitting this is what I aspire for, but you're truly not any different than the 94 percentile that did not get in, right? Right. There's nothing really quite unique about you, right? We talked about there are kids that, man, they might have done everything right, ACT scores, SAT scores, GPA. But then that school that's an elite level academic school says, you know what? Everything checks the box, except that you don't have enough science classes or science labs or some special community stuff that you're doing that differentiates you from the other 96% that have applied to school. Everyone here will have a 4.7. Everybody here will have a 1550 or 1570, right? Everyone all here will be applying, will have like a 35. But you don't have that special thing that makes you uniquely qualified to be at this academic level, right? And that's reality. Same thing with soccer, right? Like, yes, you play in a good plat a great platform. Yes, you play in a good team. Yes, your team wins. Yes, you're a very good player. However, you're missing that one little thing. You're missing that one thing that we look for, you know, to.
Andre, I've seen that at some of these ECNL and GA showcases. I just look around and watch the college coaches just walking from field to field, and they'll be watching a game that's lovely soccer, Don, like you said, and everyone is passing, connecting, good first touch, but everyone can do that pretty much at that level. So then, you know, they'll actually leave those games sometimes because it's like, okay, cool, like it's good soccer, but there's no impact player here that can come to my program and compete against our upperclassmen or fight for a starting position. So I just find it interesting when college coaches go to another field and then there's that girl who's up top who's just crushing it, finishing. She's 6 foot one or whatever. And it's just, okay, well, that's what's special about her. but then everyone else is just kind of in the background to all of that. So I think that's a good point. I think ECNLGA helps with the exposure because a lot of coaches go to these events. But what are you doing on your ECNL team that is you and contributing and that really stands out for a top 25 D1 program?
Yeah, and the competition is good. I mean, across the board, I would say, like, you know, game in, game out, the games are better, right? So that you're as a player, you're playing against better teams. But still, at the end of the day, do you have any moxie to you? That's a word that I love using. Like, this kid's got zero moxie, or this kid's got a little moxie to him, you know, whether it be like back to pressure, outside of the foot, heel flick to your, or like little flick on the outside of the foot, little chapeau, you know, spins the kid the other way, ball flicks the other way, gets around there. You know, and some kids just do too much of that. And some kids are like the perfect balance. They know when to pick their moment, when to do that. That's the kid you're like, when you look over to the coach on the sideline and go, oh man, did you see that? You know, like those are the like, oh, that was different. That was special. We talk a lot about how it's just very vanilla, right? It's like, it's a base flavor. You know, every game is like, you know, it's, oh, juego de posición. You know, it's all about positional. And it's about, like you said, passing here, like passing patterns, this and that. But sometimes, you know, I love seeing a kid just receive a ball face up and just go, I'm going at you. And just being like, oh, that kid's so unique, so special. And there's some teams that coach that way and some teams that don't coach that way. And I think college coaches, at the end of the day, they're going to go to teams that they know that's what they're coaching their kids to do, right? And so like, oh, you know, we want this approach. We want very cerebral thinking players, we're going to go to that coach because we know that's what he's going to, you know, that's what he's going to coach. That's where she's going to coach throughout their youth career. And then you have some coaches that are like, no, it's all about winning, man. We don't care about this, this, and this. We just want really great 1v1 attacking artists, attacking oriented players, right? And so as a college coach, I think you gravitate towards what you feel like your wheelhouse is and what you're trying to get.
I had a girl who told me that a college coach mentioned to her how she was the only one on the field who stepped up in the weather conditions. I forget what showcase it was. It was pretty recent, but the winds were whipping like 30 plus miles per hour. And she was the only one who stepped up, took control of the game, was making some really impact plays. And that stood out to those coaches. And I think that's also worth noting, like, how can you step up in not ideal weather conditions, or maybe when your team is down 3-0, just extra little things to stand out.
And like asking the player, like, why do you want to go to that program? Like, what is it about that program that like makes you like aspire to go there and play there? It's really finding out, like, you know, like what's the why behind there, you know? And some kids are like, oh, I don't know. It's just, you know, it's this conference. And I'm like, what does that mean to you? Well, it means it's the best of the best. I'm like, okay, so like, what if you know, you got 80 games, and what if you only play 45 or 50 games, you know, at that level? Are you just happy being on the roster? And they're like, no. And there's some, you know, like where I played, it was all about, let me go there because I want to go play pro, you know, like that's the end goal, is to play pro. This program is going to put me in the best situation. And there's probably, what do you think, Don? 15, 20 programs that consistently can shell out some pro players,
all right,
on an annual basis, right? Whether they're domestic or, and what's the definition of being a pro, right? It's
that's what I was going to say. Yeah. I mean, the number of players that get drafted, we have one of those guys working for us, Danny Reynolds, got drafted in the second round, which we would say, wow, that's really good, by Seattle. And, you know, never played for Seattle, played for their minor league team, Tacoma, and then went back east and played a little bit there, and then came back up to Sacramento and played a little bit there. And then the career's over and you never end up having a pro career. Far more of those stories than the ones who made it. And when I coached pro, very short stint, I would tell all of our rookies, stop thinking you're a pro. You're not a pro till you sign your second contract. When they want you back for a second pro contract, now you're on your way. And for some players, it's a third and a fourth contract you can't just there's semi-pro means semi-paid.
And so, Erica, like I would say, it's really, you got to have like a conversation with a kid and a family and just like, hey, are you willing to invest 100% in everything that you do, from the soccer standpoint, training more than twice a week or three times a week? Is that enough for you? No. Okay. Are you getting more? You know, are you doing this on your own? Do you have like a different, like somebody that works with you? Like, do you go out and, how many kids go out and actually, how many kids, you know, blow out their quads because they never hit balls on frame on a consistent basis, and then they go out one day and they try to hit like 60, 70 shots, and then their quads and their hamstrings are shot, like, right? Because like, oh, I've been shooting. I went out and shot like 50, 60 shots. And I'm like, yeah, you don't have the, like, you don't have the muscle strength to do that, because you never go out on your own and just go hit balls on your own. You're not that dedicated to your craft to do that. Like, how many like backs go out and hit 40, 50 yard balls on frame on their own? They don't. Like, how many kids that you know, like, hey, are you truly invested in being a top player and playing for a top conference? I'm like, do you have a bag of balls at home? Yeah. No, I don't. Like, I have one ball, and then the rest of the ball my coaches always bring out. So you rely on your coaches to always develop you. You are not invested enough, right? Whereas in Europe, right, you have the clubhouse, you go to the clubhouse. Or in college, right? You go in your locker room, you pull out two or three bags of balls, you set them down, you get your warm up in, you get some touches, and then you do your thing, right? And you do three sets of shots, and then you pull it back into the clubhouse, drop it off, and then you're done. Here, it's not set up that way. We solely rely on somebody else helping us. Now, there's some kids that do a really good job of, you know, trying to do stuff on their own, but I would say 80, 90% of them probably don't.
I think that's an important question for the parents listening to ask. Is my kid becoming best friends with the ball, not just with the skills trainer, but on their own, doing wall ball, juggling, shooting on the goal in the backyard, whatever it is? And to your point, Andre, with the strength and conditioning, are they building their bodies to be able to play at that next level? Because you watch the final of UNC versus Wake Forest this year, and the muscle mass on these girls was extremely noticeable. And I've talked to the UNC women's soccer sports scientist who does body composition testing, making sure that during the season, these girls are gaining lean muscle mass to prevent injury, to help with speed and explosiveness. So it's just the discipline that is required in all aspects of your game, physical, technical, tactical. It's just parents really need to ask, is my kid doing these? And I do want to come back to parents also asking their kid why they want to play for a top 25 D1 team, because I think we can come back to the UNC example. I don't know the full story with the exodus and transfers, but around that time, there was that hit piece written on Anson, how the culture was so competitive and crazy and the girls were upset. And I'm like, did these girls not know who this guy was? There are literally books on his competitive cauldron and who he is and how he runs the program. Like, it kind of confused me. I don't know if any of you want to chime in on that, but it's like, you should know going into UNC, that's the culture. Tony at Wake Forest, very similar thing. I've heard he's very strict. He runs a tight ship, and some girls don't do their research on that.
Yeah. I think people love the idea of playing at those programs without really understanding, like, oh, the coach, you know, like, oh, it'll be different. And like, no, like I was, you know, as much as I wanted to change as a coach, your standards are your standards, right? If you want to win and do well, you have your standards. And if your standards, you know, and I think the thing is like, oh, hey, you know, things have been slipping there. You know, they haven't won a championship. I'm like, it's still a really good program. And that's the standard that they have. Yes, you know, maybe they, you know, when they had the coaching change, the vibe maybe changed a little bit, and, you know, things, there's like a little fresh, you know, like some excitement to things. But I think that the key word is investment. Like, what's your investment in all this? Like, I go to showcases, I travel, I go this, I go to that, right? I think that there's an investment means more than what's your financial and your time commitment in terms of your training, your practices, and showcase events and league games, right? There's another investment part that I don't think kids and families really ever really kind of put their sight on it. Like, oh yeah, I mean, we're traveling every weekend and we're doing this. I'm like, Now there's a whole different level of investment in order to play at that level and sacrifice. And I go back to my kid here in Vegas. That kid, strength and conditioning from 14 on, that was religious. That was religion to her, right? Recovery. You know, what is she doing? Oh, she's doing her Normatec. You know, she's doing this, she's doing that. She's getting foam rolls, she's getting a massage. You know, like that is a professional, like that was a professional mindset, right? And it took a village, right, of people around her to help her get there. But that was internally driven, not like everybody else telling her what to do. This is like, and like I told you, she hit that wall, you know, like at 16, hit a little bit of a wall, like felt like she's missing out on a lot of different things. But now she's like, oh, it's so worth it. You know, playing in World Cups, going to my dream school, you know, training is awesome here, you know, graduated early to go join a team, went to go train in a different country to get ready for her spring season, you know. So it's your investment that really, I think, sets you apart from everybody else.
I heard a cool quote the other day. It's not about what you want, it's about what you're willing to sacrifice and give up.
Yeah. And you know what, Erica and Don, and some kids just have natural talent, and natural talents are going to get them it's going to get through, you know. Going to go far, right? Their natural ability is going to take them really, really far. They're just like an uber crazy athlete with technical skills, and they can get behind people. And some kids, I mean, how do you look at a, you know, like a Lamal who at 16, 17 is crushing it in La Liga and World Cup competition, you know, and qualifiers. And it's just that kid just has natural talent. There's kids like that. But for the most part, I think that, you know, and what we're going to see too, Don, is the proliferation of 14 and 15 year olds skipping college altogether and going pro. That's starting to happen, you know, like the kids are like, I want to be a pro. Okay, 14, 15, signed. I'm going to go be a pro.
And those are the savants. Those are the ones that it just that you were just talking about. It just everything comes naturally to them. It's not that they even not that they don't work at it. They do work at it. But you know, some people things come easier. Some kids can play the piano at three. Why? I don't know. And by the time they're 7 or 8, they're playing better than adults that had practiced their entire life. And it just comes to them. And they're, like I say, they're savants. And there are athletes that's how it works for them. And so basically what I was thinking of as we were sitting here, Erica and Andre, is that, you know, all of these areas that we're talking about are the four pillars of a player: technical, tactical, physical, and mental. You know, Andre, you're talking about bringing the balls out. That's working on the technical pieces of the game. And, you know, we're talking about your mindset. That's the mental pieces of the game. And the we can work on those. We can work on the mental pieces. We can work on the technical pieces, and we can study the game. And by the way, players, if you want to play at a top 25 D1 and you're not studying the game just as its own piece of your education. In other words, you know, how does this player play? How does that player play? How does that team play? How does this team line up differently from that team? How does this formation affect how they play? How does a team play in a low block, a mid block, and a high block? When do they press? When do they pull back? Where do they funnel players? Do they push players in? Do they push players out? Where do they do it? And in different situations, what do you do when you're up 1-0 late in the game? What do you do when you're down 1-0 late in the game? How does that change? If you're not studying the game, you're missing the tactical piece of the game. But there's one piece of the game, Erica, that falls in your area. And I think your audience probably needs to hear a reiteration of this from you as an expert. And that is, no matter how good you are with the other three, if you don't have the physical component,
Yeah.
which is my number one complaint to myself, and I roll my eyes every time. All America wants is strong, fast, physical players. That's all they focus on. It's like, well, that's all anybody focus on in any sport anywhere in the world. I mean, a swimmer who is 5'3" is not winning the 50-meter sprint in the Olympics, in the pool, right? When was the last time that you saw a 5'3" hurdler win the Olympics? It's like there's a genetics piece to this that cannot be replaced with anything else. I mean, until science allows us to genetically modify a human being, you know, which, you know, they're trying to do. They've been trying to do this for 100 years. They've been trying to genetically modify human beings to make them, you know, war monsters. We haven't figured it out. So yeah. Until that's done, then genetics is going to win. And no matter, I could have sprinted every single day of my life with the best program that the best Erica Sutter could have developed for me. And I would still never have beaten Usain Bolt ever. It's not going to happen, no matter how hard I want it. And you and I did an episode on this, Erica. Even if I do everything perfect, and Andre, you said this too, even if I do everything perfect, it doesn't mean that I'm going to be good enough to make it.
Yeah, and you have to be, you have to be okay with that, right? And I think that's a big part of it. Is you gotta have some like a self-realization, you know, like, all right, this is I'm gonna work as hard as I can, but I can't. But I think, Erica, like explaining to parents, like understanding, like what's the difference between being explosive and what's the difference between being fast, you know, like I had a conversation with a family saying, look, your first five steps, that's what coaches worry about as a defender. They're like, yeah, but she catches up to that player. I go, yeah, but at the next level, that player, the player that she's going to be dealing with is going to be a lot faster. And so once the first five steps are gone, you're basically chasing. You're not catching up, right? You don't have that. That's not where you're at. You don't train that way. Like, oh, what is that? Like, how do we do? Like, they don't even like, they're asking me like, how do we train that? And there's, that's not happening at home, right? And so you have to kind of give them like, hey, you know, maybe do this, but you should probably work with a strength and conditioning coach. It's going to a good strength and conditioning coach that understands your sport and understands what is it that you need specifically. Yes, you can close down a player in the 30 yards, right? Like your end acceleration is fine, but it's those first 5 yards that you're getting burned on, right? And then you don't have that 30 yards. You have 16 yards. You don't have time to catch up. And so I think it's just having people who are experts in that field really, really help kids understand like how they can get better. But how do you do that if you're not evaluating players on a consistent basis as a strength conditioning coach, right? Even like when I was coaching in college, like our strength conditioning coaches would show up at practice and they would show up at games. The good ones, right, would show up and they would watch and they'd go, oh, I see what you mean.
Yeah.
Like, oh yeah, you know, they can't turn, you know, like their ability to turn and accelerate, you know, it's she needs to train that. She doesn't have that, you know. And then I'm like, oh, quick twitch fiber versus slow twitch fiber. I'm not changing that. That's you're born with that, you know. And so I think more of that education needs to happen to understand, like, go evaluate what I wish we could get the data points from those top 25 programs in terms of like, what are the, you know, the physical standards that they're looking for? What is it that they're looking for in terms of their training? What's the standard across the board, right? Like, what's the baseline numbers for each kid and where are they going from there? And I don't know, you know, if we can get that, but that would be really helpful.
Yeah, there's a few. I mean, for the speed side of things, usually Division I running top end speed over 17 and a half, 18 miles per hour. And then a lot of the programs do the yo-yo tests for the speed, endurance, conditioning, and they're having their girls come in.
But what do you do when the people on social, like, I'm not trying to trash social media, but people are like, oh, you know, it's not part of the game, the fitness test, and why are you running that? But go ahead and explain to them why that's important.
Well, at that level, they want to have objective data and some sort of standard. And I think the yo-yo test is a little bit more transferable in terms of conditioning. It used to be that these teams did more like the mile, 2 mile, but people started to catch on, oh, soccer is not just jogging the whole 90 minutes. It's sprint and then stop, then sprint again, then walk. So they're starting to get better with the test selection, but I think with the yo-yo test, a lot of these top 25 D1 programs are requiring you have to be at a level 35 or 40 and above to just even like get a starting position. I know Anson at UNC had that a few years ago, but it's pretty cutthroat. You know, I'm not saying the players train in the offseason to pass the test, still touch the ball, play 11v11, like get good at the game and get fast as hell and you'll be okay. But it takes a lot of work, and you can't just get fast from a 4-week speed program. Speed takes many months, many years, and it's a highly advanced skill. And yeah, kind of coming back to your athlete, Andre, who religiously started strength, speed, and conditioning at age 14 and continued all those years, that's the ideal situation because there's a lot going on during adolescence with body changes. There has to be a proper progression in place, proper load monitoring in place, so she doesn't get injured and she still optimizes her performance. So the ideal situation is to have these athletes long-term to build these physical qualities. And then when they get to college, they're probably going to meet their strength coach first and their strength coach will test them. And then they'll go to practice that night. They might have 2-a-days and they have to be able to handle all of that and play small-sided games, play 11v11. So yeah, the physical component's key, but I think everyone needs to focus on everything. Raise the ceiling on every part of your game, physical, technical, tactical, mental, and you'll be great. But it takes a lot of work. It takes a lot of consistency.
And have a plan. And everybody communicate with each other. Like, this dad was religious about communicating with me about what she was doing, where she was. And sometimes I'm like, well, she's not training today. Then they're like, what? I'm like, yeah, I'm shutting her down. She's not going to train. I'm like, you think that's right? Do you think that's good? I'm like, 100%. You know, like less is more sometimes, you know, like that whole adage. But I think that if everybody's on the same page, and that's the problem, is I don't think that you get a lot of people that communicate with each other and understand. And since at the club level, you don't usually have a strength coach that works with every team, right? And so everybody's independent. Everybody has a different philosophy. Everybody has a different way of monitoring things. So that becomes a little bit more difficult.
Yeah. And it comes back to what is everyone willing to invest in terms of time and money? So that's definitely a question to ask as well. And Don, do you have any other final words for parents and this whole topic around top 25 D1?
Dang, we covered a lot. We did it for a whole hour, Eric. I didn't, you know, we went from 5 words beyond the national team to some good detailed information. I'm glad you joined us, Andre. I appreciate that.
Yeah, no problem. Glad I could help, but it's a different world out there.
Well, thank you guys for tuning in, and hopefully this covered all of your questions for top 25 D1 schools. Feel free to leave a comment, ask any questions you might have. I'll leave Andre and Don's social media and contact in the caption below. So feel free to reach out if you have any personal questions, and I will see you all next time.